Senate Judiciary Committee to order. Today is Monday, February 18th. Let the record reflect the time is 1:33 p.m. Today we have present Vice Chair Senator Reinbold, Senator Chickie, and myself, Chair Senator Hughes. I'd like to remind you to silence your cell phones. Thank you for those assisting us today. Today we'll have invited testimony followed by public testimony for both SB 12 and SB 35. And once we've concluded testimony, if we have time, we'll ask Mr. Skidmore, Director of the Criminal Division of the Department of Law, to pick up where we left on Friday in the committee's analysis of Senate Bill 35. So to get us started this afternoon, I'd like to invite Ms. Carmen Lowry, the Executive Director of the Alaskan Network on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault, to the table. Welcome, Ms. Lowry. Please place your name on the record and begin your testimony.
Okay, thank you very much. Good morning. My name is Carmen Lowry, and I'm the Executive Director of the Alaska Network on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault. I want to first say that I'm extremely grateful for the invitation to speak with you all today. My presentation's about 10 minutes. I'm going to cover a brief introduction to the network, talk about some highlights from both SB 12 and 35, specifically dealing with strangulation, give a brief explanation of strangulation due to its prominence in informing these bills, and then finally, conclusion into context and data as a way to inform where we might move forward. ANDVSA was established in 1977 when five programs that were based in Anchorage, Fairbanks, Juneau, Kenai, and Nome came together to talk about how they could be more effective, have greater coordination, and influence policies and legislation. Today, we have 24 members, and we are driven by our mission to be a collective movement to end violence and oppression through social change. Our members include the following: Advocates for Victims of Violence in Valdez, Abused Women's Aid in Crisis in Anchorage, AWARE, based here in Juneau, Arctic Women in Crisis, Utqiagvik, Bering Sea Women's Group in Nome, Cordova Family Resource Center in Cordova, Interior Alaska Center for Nonviolent Living in Fairbanks, Kodiak Women's Resource and Crisis Center, the Lee Shore Center in Kenai, Manilik Family Crisis Center in Kotzebue, Safe and Fear-Free Environment in Dillingham, Sitkins Against Family Violence in Sitka, Seaview Community Services in Seward, South Peninsula Haven House in Homer, Standing Together Against Rape in Anchorage, Tundra Women's Coalition in Bethel, Unalaskans Against Sexual Assault and Family Violence in Unalaska, Women in Safe Homes in Ketchikan, Working Against Violence for Everyone in Petersburg, My House, Wasilla, Becky's Place, Haines, Helping Ourselves Prevent Emergencies in Craig, and the Native Village of Iak Arnot Women's Project in Cordova. I want to briefly just tell a little bit about me because I want you all to know who's sitting at your table. I'm originally from Western Kentucky. My family's been there for five generations being farmers. I grew up knowing seven of my eight great-grandparents. I started this work in 1990 as a children's advocate at the New Beginning Shelter in Seattle and then migrated to Bethel to work at the Tundra Women's Coalition from 1992 to 1997. I've continued working on issues of gender-based violence, domestic and sexual violence in humanitarian settings that included Darfur, Lebanon, Iraq, Burma, and East Timor. In order to learn more, take a break from the work, and gain research skills, I returned to graduate school twice, earning my doctorate in communication in 2013. I moved back here to Alaska in 2016, and before that I was 2 years in Nairobi providing technical assistance to programs in the Horn of Africa. So it's my goal to be a technical resource for you all, and it's also my goal to work with our network and member programs so that they also can provide their technical assistance to you all. I want to say thank you very much for the legislative responses to the Schneider case, to the impact of strangulation that's been very much also a part of Ashley Johnson Barr's case. With respect to Senate Bill 12, please note that the network is specifically pleased to note that the three major impacts on Alaska sexual assault laws, and this was explained by Senator Machicki in his sponsor statement, are all impacts we agree with. One, requiring that strangulation to the point of unconsciousness is defined as assault in the first degree. 2, to eliminate credit toward time served for electronic monitoring or private residence for sexual assault convictions, and then also classifying unwanted contact with semen as a sexual crime. In SB 35, there's some very close parallels that also address similar concerns, and we believe that these also will have a demonstrable impact on our sexual assault laws. And we can hear the similarities. 1, amending the definition of sexual contact to include contact with semen, making unwanted contact with semen as a sexual offense requiring registration as a sex offender. Enhanced strangulation sentencing, revising our out-of-state sex offender registration process that requires people who have been registered in other states to register in our state regardless of if there's a similar law. And then the marriage defense to sexual assault. Very grateful for that. I want to share with you all a bit of information because strangulation is so prominent in both of these, because it's such a deadly tactic. I, along with Dr. Tracy Weiss, wrote an op-ed piece that ran in several papers here in Juneau and in the Anchorage Daily News, some others, about strangulation. And I want to assure you all that before we ran that, because we did talk about Ashley Johnson Barr, I called the family to make sure that they were okay with us invoking her experience to illustrate problems with strangulation. Here are some key excerpts from that document. First of all, it's important to note that strangulation results in cerebral hypoxia. And all that means is that there's not enough oxygen delivered to the brain to maintain the functioning of the brain, and that brings about a loss of consciousness. A victim who's being strangled may lose consciousness in as little as 10 seconds. That is all it takes. And in those 10 seconds, they're often filled with feelings of confusion, of disbelief, of disorientation, and a firm, firm belief that I will die. Now, if a victim consistently experiences bouts of these non-fatal strangulation where critical areas of the brain do not get enough oxygen or neurological input, they may experience diminished brain functioning, which means ongoing memory loss and or small minor strokes. In 2008, Dr. Nancy Glass, who's done a lot of research on gender-based violence, conducted a study and reported that non-fatal strangulation is an important risk factor for homicide in domestic violence victims. This means that when victims report that their partners have choked them, which is often what people say, these victims are at higher risk of being murdered by their partners. And what is particularly challenging within the area of strangulation is that oftentimes strangulation can occur and there's no marks because that occurred. You don't have to squeeze, you just have to put the pressure. That's why training and awareness is so important, and that's why we have to remember that victims are not choked, they're strangled, and that's why terminology is so important. So I just want to close up, and I want to share some data with you all from the State of Alaska 2017 Felony Level Sex Offense Report. I think that you all have seen that. Very telling. And one of the things that we know by looking at that, and what can we know from data, is that it shows that the felony level sex offenses are being both victimization and perpetration is being experienced by younger people. And it's also disproportionately being experienced both in terms of victims and suspects by Alaska Native people. The data, because the report breaks it down into the geographical areas, the most common age, so that's the age that occurs the most, for victims across these five geographical regions range from 12 years old to 19. So out of the nearly 1,500 victims reporting in 2017, 45% of those were Alaska Native females. The most common age for suspects across that five geographic region range from 17 to 28 years old. And out of the 1,442 suspects, 36% were Alaska Native men, or Alaska Native, and the majority of all suspects, 95%, are male. And finally, and this was very chilling to me as well, in 97% of these 1,500 cases or incidents of felony-level sex offenses, the victim and the suspect knew each other. And approximately 76% of the incident locations were reported as a residence or home. So I want to thank you for allowing me to have this time. I'm happy to answer some questions or to get back in touch with you. I want to close just by saying I think that there's lots of information. There's lots of data out there. And I think that we really are poised, and you are already poised and moving forward with making some decisions based on the information that we know. We can change this. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Lowry, for your testimony and for the expertise that you're offering to this committee. You did mention in your comments that you referred to the Barr case. I think we're all aware of the Justin Schneider case that's been in the news, made national news, and was more recent. Could you explain, give some background on the Barr case, please?
In the Barr case, when I didn't bring my article with me, but the earliest news releases in several of the papers referenced a report that had come out, and in that report it was said that she was discovered with ligature marks on her. And so I didn't know what that was, so I had to look that up. And ligature marks are marks that are made by tying something around, whether it's a rope or a cord or something. So there's two different types, as explained in strangulation. One is a manual. People will use their hands or their arms or their foot, mm-hmm. something else to put pressure. And then some of the other ones are when people have things wrapped around to stop the flow of oxygen. And I was just really struck by that and thought how painful that must be for anyone to have that image.
Thank you for that clarification. Senator Reinbold.
Just a couple things. I don't know if you're testifying for or against the bill or if this is just in general, so if you could clarify that. And second, if we could get your written testimony through the chair, that'd be awesome. Thank you. Okay. Great job.
Through the chair, Senator Reinbold, because both of we are not quite prepared as the network to take a firm stance, I can tell you that we definitely are very much in support, I would say, of all of the elements of the bill. But because we are a membership-based organization, it is my responsibility to make sure I go through my committees to ensure that they are in agreement. So when I say that the network supports, you all know all those members I read off support. So we'll be having a meeting tomorrow, so we should be able to submit some letters clearly articulating what we do support.
Thank you, Senator Reinbold.
Anything? And any amendments that you think it would be helpful that would really help us, okay? Thank you.
Thank you. Senator Michicki, did you have anything?
I don't. It was Senator Reinbold covered. You put out, I'm a quick writer, and you spoke faster than I could write, so I would also like to see the testimony in print, please.
Yeah, thank you very much, Dr. Lowry. And next, I'd like to invite Ms. Elizabeth Williams with the organization No More Free Passes to the table. Welcome, Ms. Williams. Please place your name on the record and begin your testimony.
Good afternoon. My name is Elizabeth Williams, and I am the founder of No More Free Passes. Thank you, Senator Hughes, for inviting me to speak today. No More Free Passes is a nonpartisan advocacy organization that was founded in September of 2018 the day after the Justin Schneider sentencing. And I'm not going to go over that case again because I'm going to trust that you all are familiar with that case. But why did we form? We formed because the crime that Justin Schneider committed was so horrible that it sparked an Alaska-wide and a national-wide outrage. It was covered from, you know, tiny little papers in Bethel, Alaska, to Al Jazeera and the New York Times and the Washington Post. So we had all this Alaskan and national outrage, but the state of Alaska's response was shockingly inadequate. We felt that there was mistakes made by both the prosecutors. There was mistakes in our laws that have been around for decades. There was mistakes made by the judge, and I believe there was mistakes made by the state of Alaska in the way they responded to the public outrage. We were grateful when former Governor Walker proposed legislation to close the semen loophole, but we felt like even that did not go far enough, and that is why we formed, and that is why we are focusing on legislative advocacy. We felt that, as former Governor Walker had proposed that the semen loophole needed to be closed, that contact, non-consensual contact with semen needed to be included in the definition of sexual contact. But what really kept me up at night, what really haunted me, was the other part of the assault that also received no jail time, and that was strangulation. The fact that the victim of Justin Schneider passed out believing that she was going to die, and she told me that she looked into his eyes as he told her that she was going to die, and she really believed that his eyes was the last thing she was ever going to see. The fact that she is now at risk for TBI, for amnesia, for PTSD, for depression, for anxiety, for mood changes, that's what keeps me up at night. And the fact that the state of Alaska thought that that deserves zero jail time. I think most of us are aware that domestic violence is a critical issue here in the state of Alaska, as well as sexual assault, and strangulation is one of the most heinous actions within those categories. It's been described as waterboarding of domestic violence. Waterboarding, as you know, is a form of torture where you cut off someone's ability to breathe. That's what strangulation is like. I don't think there's anything more terrifying than feeling like you can't breathe and you can't fight this person off. A little bit separate from the Justin Schneider case, but a lot of strangulation takes place in the home with children around. I was a social worker in Bethel, Alaska for a year and a half, and I worked with lots of children. And one of the worst things that children would ever tell me was, "Daddy chokes mommy." We know that exposure to domestic violence is the most negative thing that can happen in a child's life. It is more negative than actually experiencing physical violence themselves. That's why I ask that strangulation be taken extremely, extremely seriously in our criminal code. And I want to thank Senator Machicki for authoring Senate Bill 12, which does just that. And now, so what can we do about strangulation? What can we do about sexual assault? I don't think incarceration is the answer to everything. But here's what incarceration can do. Incarceration can mean that that victim has a year, 2 years, 3 years to get her life back together. To not just go to a shelter for a couple weeks and then return back to that home, but the chance to actually get a job, get support, and get her own house, hopefully. That's 1, 2, 3, 4 years for these children to not have to go home to a war zone every night after school. That's what incarceration can do. Which brings me to the third portion of SB 12, which is that it would eliminate credit for time on electronic monitoring. Credit for time on electronic monitoring came about in 2015 through House Bill 15. SB 12 would eliminate it for sexual assault offenses. We believe that sexual assault should equal jail time, not time spent at home. Justin Schneider spent the total of his sentence 1 year sitting in his luxury home overlooking Kachemak Bay, where he had his children. He could drink what he wanted, he could eat what he wanted, he could surf the internet, he could make all the phone calls he wanted, he could go to appointments. That was his jail time. One of the tangible effects of giving credit for time spent on electronic monitoring at home is that defendants facing trial have incentive to delay trial as long as they possibly can. And I know this, our board is comprised of former prosecutors, current defense attorneys, and people who have worked in corrections, and this is something that they've told me. I spoke with an attorney who's going to a sexual assault trial from 2012. Defendants know that if they're sitting at home on electronic monitoring, they're getting credit for every single day that they're spending at home. And so if they can find reason after reason to delay trial, when they go to trial, worst case scenario, they get convicted, but they've already served 1, 2, 3 years of their sentence. So that incentive to delay trials is terrible for victims. A victim might have the motivation to go and report her sexual assault the morning after. She might even have the motivation to testify at a grand jury hearing a couple days later or a bail hearing. But to hold her to coming back 3 years later to testify about something that she wants to forget, something that she wants to move on, that's just too much to ask. And it's also bad for the public. People facing trial who are sitting at home, they still do have access to children unless the judge specifically says that they can't. They still have access to the public. So again, we support SB 12. We also support SB 35, which includes a lot of these other provisions. We are really, really happy that it also addresses stipulation, and I think SB 35 and SB 12 will work really, really well together. SB 12 will make assault where you can prove loss of consciousness, assault in the first degree, so the most serious type of assault, recognizing that they're within seconds of death. But in those cases where we might not be able to prove loss of consciousness, it will still fall under assault in the second degree, and SB 35 increases the sentencing range. So now prosecutors will have two different tools. If they can prove loss of consciousness, they can get them assault in the first degree, which is like 10 to 15 years of jail time. But if not, they can still get the enhanced jail time under assault in the second degree, which will be really, really helpful for our prosecutors. And I just want to close again by saying thank you. And I want to say that we need action. We don't need awareness. Alaska has done awareness campaign after awareness campaign. We've authored study after study. And the time for that is over. We have the numbers. We know that we're the worst in the nation. We have the stories. It's time to make really real change now. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Williams, for your testimony. Are there any questions for the caller? Senator Reinbold.
Outstanding job. Thank you very much. That was heartfelt, and you bring an amazing amount of knowledge, compassion, you know, to the victims, and also just some real insights on the law. So thank you very, very much, and I look forward to working with you.
Thank you, Senator Reinbold.
You, thank you, Chair, for having her here.
Yes. Senator Matiki.
I guess what I have is just sincere thanks to Elizabeth and her team. You know, the public was all mortified, angry, sort of sitting around in disbelief about what happened with the Schneider case. But a lot of people don't know what to do from there. And you did what needed to be done. You all mobilized, put the right folks together, started calling policymakers, and that's what needed to happen. So you actually helped motivate me. I mean, we'd been looking since the incident, we'd been looking at sort of where to go on this. You really helped motivate me on not trying to change the entire criminal justice world, but to fix what happened with the Justin Schneider case. And that's what this bill is about, because the public deserves that. Those sitting around in disbelief that all know a victim or many victims, depending on whether or not you're in an agency or not, need to know that that is not going to happen again. So thank you so much, Elizabeth, for your help in keeping us focused, pinpoint focused on the case, which so many Alaskans lost their faith in their system over. I think we can bring them back by letting them know that when these things occur, we're going to stop them.
Thank you, Senator Chiki.
Thank you, and I'll just say I'll echo Senator Michiki's comments, and sometimes life has us so we're maybe a day or two behind on the news, and that was where I was when that came out in September, but I've known Elizabeth and her family, known her since she was a toddler, and so when I caught the news, it was at the same time that you had already mobilized, and I thought, okay, something's going to happen, just knowing Elizabeth's family. And was grateful when I heard that Senator Michiki had filed SB 12. So thank you very much for your testimony. And next we will call up Ms. Keely Olson. She is the Executive Director of STAR, Standing Together Against Rape. Oh, she is not in the room. She is online. So Ms. Olson, please place your name on the record and begin your testimony.
Hello. For the record, my name is Keely Olson. I am the Executive Director of Standing Together Against Rape, or STAR, in Anchorage. I am representing the agency, as well as many survivors of sexual assault and abuse that it serves. Thank you very much for inviting me to provide testimony on these bills, and thank you for advancing these crucial bills which address loopholes in state statutes. Each of these loopholes addressed by these bills were to be policy priorities set by STAR. It was excellent to see these bills pre-filed, and now I understand with the assistance of Ms. Williams, either by Senator Michiki or the governor, which I think illustrates the dire needs all across the state to hold sexual predators accountable. As stated by both Dr. Lowry and Ms. Williams, I won't review everything that the bill contains. I will say that I could not agree more strongly with these proposed bills and would like to add a few examples for you of the importance of updating these statutes. Unfortunately, as you've been made aware, or you are already familiar with the tragic murder of young Ashley Johnson Barr in Kotzebue and the unfortunate sentencing of Justin Schneider in Anchorage, I imagine SB 12 was drafted with these cases in mind. Strangulation is a hideously common form of violence used in conjunction with sexual assault. Traumatic brain injuries we see in survivors are generally attributable to their being strangled, sometimes repeatedly, to unconsciousness. I personally worked with a young woman in Anchorage some years ago who was strangled during a sexual assault. She was immediately evaluated at the hospital as a standard procedure in a vast number of START responses in Anchorage. She came to the STAR office for ongoing assistance immediately after her release from the hospital. She was provided emergency shelter and transportation, but collapsed as soon as she arrived to her room. Emergency responders were called without delay. She never regained consciousness and died 2 days later. Her offender was not held accountable. Another case, Richard Dale Abrahamson, age 36, is a registered sex offender from Iowa who told police he moved to Alaska for a fresh start in 2016. He was under the impression he would not have to register in Alaska. This was before the Supreme Court ruled that, in fact, many registered sex offenders from other jurisdictions would not have to register. He is accused of sexually abusing a 13-year-old boy within days of his arrival here, and face 7 felony charges. To echo what Ms. Williams said, even though he made admissions of guilt and there was filmed evidence on his camera of the abuse, the case just went to trial at the end of January 2019, nearly 3 years later. He is awaiting sentencing and appears to have been acquitted on at least some of these charges. The Justin Schneider case certainly illustrated the need to include masturbation without consent as a sex offense. The only question or possible concern that I have about the current wording in the bill is whether it requires the offender climax to be considered a sex offense. The current wording, as I see it, is to engage in masturbation and ejaculate on a person without the consent of that person. If we were to look at the Schneider case, if he had not climaxed, would the victim be any less sexually assaulted? I wonder about the terminology masturbation without consent for the purpose of sexual gratification, rather than requiring ejaculation as a factor in the law. That's not something that I can answer, but it might be a question that you could advance further. Removing the marriage defense is a critical need. There have been several cases of sexual assault in the second degree in Anchorage that fall under this fact pattern. As an example, STAR provided services to a woman who was raped by her spouse after gynecological surgery. She was on prescribed medication to help her sleep, ordered to get ample bed rest, and ordered not to engage in sexual intercourse for at least 4 weeks. Her spouse was aware of these medical constraints. He raped her within days of her surgery while she was on sleep medication and unable to consent. She required emergency medical treatment as a result, and he was never charged with a sexual assault. The marriage defense for sexual assault in the second degree is problematic, especially for couples who are estranged, but due to finances or abuse, elect to remain married and living together. This is becoming more and more common as the cost of housing increases while the economy faces setbacks. It is more of a burden for low-income individuals and victims of domestic and economic abuse whose spouses refuse to initiate a divorce and who cannot on their own afford legal representation. For all these reasons and more, I urge you to advance these bills and pass them swiftly. Thank you again for your time and attention to these matters of critical urgency.
Thank you very much. Ms. Olson, are there questions or comments for Ms. Olson? Senator Reinbold.
If we could get her testimony was excellent as well, if we could get that in writing. And thank you for your testimony, and just really makes us want to get these bills to the finish line. So thank you very much. And if you have suggestions through the chair or whoever you'd like, please get us information on any amendments that you think would be good for this bill, if there's issues that you're seeing at STAR, where there's any other loopholes. I'd rather be preventative than having to, do something reactive, with this like the suggestion Snyder. If we can look forward and around the corner, that would be really, really great. So thank you, and thank you for what you do. You're really appreciated.
And Ms. Olson, we will follow up on your question with the Department of Law regarding how it's written as far as whether there's climax or not. So, Senator Michiki, did you have any comments or questions?
I do. I have a comment, Madam Chair. Thank you. For all three of our testifiers so far, which are sort of representing all of the major agencies in the state, I believe the public does not realize that strangulation is a relatively common approach, if you will, and we could use the statistical support and perhaps examples where they can be made public, of course, not including the victims' names, but I think folks need to understand that is just because they learned about strangulation as being a method used for sexual assault in the Justin Schneider case doesn't mean it's a rare tactic.
Thank you for those comments, Senator Michiki. We have another person online who is going to testify under invited testimony, and that's Ms. Victoria Shanklin, who is the Executive Director of Victims for Justice. Ms. Shanklin, please place your name on the record and proceed with your testimony.
Hello, yes. My name is Victoria Shanklin, and I'm the Executive Director of Victims for Justice. I'd like to thank you as well for inviting me to testify. I will speak now on behalf of our organization and the Victims Reserve, and I will keep it a bit short because much has already been mentioned, but Victims for Justice is an organization that serves victims of violent crime, and we specialize in serving victims of assault, arson, robbery, and homicide. Unfortunately, it's not uncommon for offenders in the cases that we have to have had priors, and for those to not have been taken as seriously as they should have, whether through loopholes or not giving credit to the severity of the crimes committed. So again, for many of the same reasons that have already been mentioned, we support SB 12 and 35 and anything that strengthens the system prior to the crimes resulting in a homicide. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Ms. Shanklin. Are there comments or questions for Ms. Shanklin? Senator Reinbold?
This is a little off topic, but how are you all funded, Victims for Justice, and are you well-staffed? I mean, you're dealing with huge things like assault and homicide, et cetera. So just wondering your funding sources, and are you getting resources that you need with this incredibly high rise in crime that's happening to deal with these victims?
Thank you for asking. We are a very small organization. We have 4 full-time employees and 1 part-time. We are working on increasing that, but I think, with the increase of homicide and the length of time that takes and the number of people who are impacted by something like that, it is a struggle for us. We are funded by a series of grants, and actually a quarter of it is through donations, but our grants come from state, federal, and municipal sources, and then a quarter of our budget is from individuals donating.
Follow-up, Senator Reinbold?
No, just thank you. I would love to learn more about your organization, but I'm thankful for the introduction today.
Thank you. Yeah, we'd be happy to share.
Senator Michiki, you have any comments?
I don't, Madam Chair. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. I want to thank you, Ms. Shanklin, and the others who just testifying, Dr. Laurie, Ms. Williams, Ms. Olson, for not only your significant testimony that's really helpful as we go through these very important bills, but also for the work that you do, your dedication to help people in Alaska. It's a kind of job, I know, just based on your dedication, you'd like to work yourself out of a job, of the job you're in right now, for these problems to be solved. And as someone mentioned earlier, it's time to take action, not just create awareness, and that is what we're trying to do as we work through these bills. So thank you. And with that, we are now ready to begin public testimony. Do you have a comment?
No.
And so I'm going to open public testimony at this point. And in the room, I did see that there is someone in the room. Yes, Katie Boats, if you'd like to come forward and sit at the table. We welcome you to the Judiciary Committee. And if you would please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony on one or both of these bills, SB 12 and SB 35.
Thank you for allowing me to come and talk to you guys. My name is Katie Boats. Originally, I was raised in Kodiak, Alaska, where at the age of 12, I was a victim of sexual abuse at my home. As many statistics show that, you know, the victim knows the person who raped you and whatnot, the person who did to me was a friend of my brother's. At the time, my house was a place where my friends and my brother's friends, we could come over and spend time at the but a safe place. We would play video games, we would have a pool table, we would play darts, anything, until I was abused. It was multiple attempts. The person is Alaska Native. I was 12, he was 18, so there's a 6 years difference. I tried to hide in every room. I tried to sneak in every room. I tried to go in every closet. He knew my family's sleeping schedule. He knew my family's work schedule. So he worked around that. And he knew the house was open for everyone. As far as being strangled, as far as the difficulties, you know, I was in, say, a brother's closet. He would pull my hair. To grab my throat, and that just as painful as using anything else. My mother, of all things, caught him in the act, and not only did it break her heart, but it devastated mine. I never wanted my mother to see such devastation in her family. She was the one who kicked him out of the house. She was the one who called the cops and set the procedures in place. I was 12. What was a 12-year-old supposed to do? After going to court and having the rape test done, to this day, I wish that she had more than 6 years in prison. To this day, even though I wasn't strangled by anything, I wasn't used, there was no tools or anything, to this day, I remember it as if it was yesterday. Mm-hmm. For 5 years, every night, I cried myself to sleep because I did not want to go to sleep. I had nightmares for 5 days in a row. All the nightmares of which I have never spoken to, not even to my parents, no therapist, no friends, no nothing, because of possibly the stigma and just kind of embarrassing coming from a victim to share. To this day, like I said, I wish he had more than 6 years, because it took me approximately 12 years to recover from my abuse. Part of it was, you know, people tried to help me out, people tried to allow me to talk, the topic that for some victims it's just hard to open up about. I read Senate Bill 35 line by line, and I would have to say, as a victim of sexual abuse, I do support it. It's already difficult with just the knowledge of Alaska has the highest sex crime in America. If protecting the public is government best interest, then outside residents coming to Alaska shouldn't be limited to register under AS 12.63.100. All Alaskan residents should have the right to know who they are associating with, as well as their families. Incitement of a minor, a crime is still a crime, regardless of how it is committed. Therefore, it should be properly documented as a sex offender, as in regarding to Section 6. In regarding to Section 7 of Senate Bill 36, line 27, the line of workforce, sexual harassment are not only embarrassing, but isn't respected by proper authority oftentimes. So victims have a harder time of going to the HR or the supervisors when it comes to sexual assault. So I've heard from others. Please have something to help victims better in this regard to feel more comfortable in reporting such harassment. And regarding to Section 14, AS 1255.1.25, with all due respect, any less than 10 years in imprisonment doesn't do the justice to the victims. The defendant have less than 10 years, then they will have freedom, but the victim has a lifelong of knowledge that she was abused. I urge at least the 20 years for victim 13 and older, and 30 years for victims under 13, just to allow the victim to have a peace of mind. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Katie, for your very brave testimony. And I believe I can speak on behalf of our committee members. Your testimony was very moving and hit us at the heart level, but also at the head level, we know there's work to do based on the things that you testified. So thank you. Thank you very much for coming today. I know that wasn't easy, and I really appreciate it, Senator Reinbold.
Well, I also wanted to say thank you. It's got to have been tough to come today and share your testimony. There's lots and lots of other Alaskans out there that need you. Only 1% of rapists end up in jail in Alaska, according to the statistics. And that has just crushed my heart. I want to do something about it. I want to fight against this. And I've written down what your suggestions are, and I think they're very good suggestions. So I know that people are going to think, oh, whoa, those are tough. But you know what? I think you've made some excellent, excellent points that a lot of our criminal justice system does not focus on the victim. And that's why I think our statistics are so doggone bad. So anyway, thanks. I hope you'll work with us and you'll stay involved. And we hope you continue to heal each and every day and help those around you, because you're making a difference.
Thank you very much. I'm sorry, if you could stay, Katie, for a moment. Senator Michicki, I'm sorry.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Katie, you're an amazing young woman for being here, and I can't tell you how much I appreciate your courage. And Senator Reinbold covered that, but I have four daughters. One of them is 12. And I don't even know how to imagine what a parent would feel like, let alone the victim at 12 years old. So I really appreciate your bravery and what you are doing to take people off the streets that may be a repeat offender. You are saving someone, maybe many people, from that same experience by being here. On the Section 14, remember, that's just, and we can cover this when we get into the details of the bill, but that is just a specific subset. The for the more serious crimes that we're dealing with in both bills, there's a much longer term that can be extended for aggravators. So we'll talk about that in detail later, but I just wanted to separate those two issues so you knew that someone that was guilty of what happened with you could be in prison for a much, much longer time. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Ms. Potts. And next, we will go online to Anchorage. Diane Schenker, would you please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony?
Thank you, through the chair. I would like to testify that I support these bills. I'm ashamed of my home state for having such poor laws and policies in place that Justin Schneider was allowed to kidnap, strangle to unconsciousness, and ejaculate on a woman, and then waltz out of the courtroom with a zero jail time. I was born in Alaska, and I have lived here my whole life. It is impossible for me to find words that fully convey the anger, resentment, and sheer fatigue of being a female in a state that has consistently been the nation's worst for tolerating violence against and disrespect for women. I spent 30 years working in Alaska's criminal justice system, including 8 years as a correctional officer and sergeant working in our state's first institutional sex offender treatment program. Rarely have I seen sex predators held even close to fully accountable for the lifelong harms they caused their victims. And in the past several years, our laws have actually been getting even more imbalanced in favor of criminals over victims. Never underestimate the ability of sexual predators who are master manipulators to get people to feel sorry for them. Mm-hmm. This bill is finally a step in the right direction. Please make these bills are steps in the right direction. Please make them your priority. There be no controversy or debate that these changes are needed. Please pass them quickly. Break records to get it done, just as voters in Alaska's 3rd Judicial District broke records unseating a judge who failed to protect our interests. Thanks to the governor, to Senator McKeachy, to the No More Free Passes organizers, to Chair Hughes, and to each committee member who acts to fix our weak laws. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Schenker. Next, we'll go to Soldatna Michelle Vasquez.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the Judiciary Committee. My name is Michelle Vasquez, and I'm speaking for myself. I support Senate Bill 12, which closes the so-called Schneider loophole in the AK criminal code. Most in Alaska were outraged when Justin Schneider walked out of court with time served on an ankle monitor as his only punishment after he kidnapped and strangled a woman and performed a sexual act over her unconscious body. This was a violent sexual assault, and no one who commits such an act should be allowed to walk away without serving time. I applaud Senator Michiki for bringing this bill forward, and I will applaud the day it becomes law. Also, if I might add, I would like to see an amendment added to Senate Bill 35 that will protect sex workers from being sexually assaulted or coerced into sex acts by some in law enforcement prior to arrest. As a state, we must do everything in our power to protect all from any kind of sexual assault, abuse, or coercion. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Ms. Vasquez. Next, we'll go to Palmer. Mike Coons is on the line. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Yeah, thank you, Senator Hughes. My name is Mike Coons from Palmer, and I'm speaking for myself. I support SB 35, but I do have concerns, and I want to see tougher sentencing. Section 15, pages 7 through 10, specifically page 7, lines 15 and 16, quote, sexual assault in the first degree, sexual assault abuse of a minor in the first degree, or sex trafficking in the first degree, end quote. Then lines 16 and 17 may be sentenced to a definite term of imprisonment of not more than 99 years, end quote. From there in other pages, that's lesser and lesser sentencing, and there's always the, quote, if first offense, end quote. Senator Hughes and members, those victims that physically survived those rapes, abuse of a minor, and sex trafficking will live with that pain for the rest of their lives, as the first testifier so eloquently stated. They at least will be free to get the help, needed help and support of their families and what the communities can offer, and over time can have some sense of healing. The lowest of low criminals that commit these crimes today may face some time in prison, but make no mistake, they will recommit again and again once they are released back onto the communities. Studies show pedophiles have about a zero recidivism rate. Same goes with the vast majority of rapists, although in places like Norway, where they can't be castrated, there is some increase in recidivism. Still, not near enough. That said, as far as I'm concerned, the need for sexual assault in any other degrees is pretty much a waste of time and effort. These predators, once caught, need one thing and one thing only: life in prison, no parole, no time off for good behavior. I go further and have a segregated wing of the prisoners to just these predators. Max security, 1 hour to walk a small courtyard per day, and if raining, too bad. Senator Hughes and committee members, this has gone on too long, and what we have tried has shown that these predators, if given any chance, will rape and defile over and over again until they either die in prison or are taken out by law enforcement or by private citizens protecting themselves or others. Please change the sentencing to my request and show these predators that they are not welcome in Alaska. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony today, Mr. Coons. Next, we'll go to Kodiak, Tanya Sylvia Johnson.
Yes, hi. My name is Tanya Sylvia Johnson. I'm calling from Kodiak. I am calling in support of SB 12 and 35. And to echo what other people have already said, I'll keep it brief. I am a rape survivor. I was raped my senior year of high school here at Kodiak High School. And since then, I have continued to speak out in our community to raise awareness and help other victims come forward if they so choose. What I have found out is that so many women that I went to school with here in Kodiak and at UAS were also raped by someone they knew, and none of them reported it. Why come forward and rape or report when there's no consequences? We need accountability. Surviving a rape requires extensive therapy and work to overcome, and even overcome, that scar is still there. So it's critically important that we have accountability and that we start saying, yes, they deserve. You know, so often we hear, do they deserve to lose this? Do they deserve to lose their career? Yes, the price has been too high for victims and for too long. And I appreciate everything that you're doing on these bills, and I thank you for your time.
Thank you, Ms. Sylvia Johnson, for your bravery today and your particularly connecting the low reporting that we have with the fact that the sentences are lenient, and if we make the sentences tougher, the reporting will probably go up. So I just appreciate that you pointing that out. And Senator Reinbold has a comment or question.
And your story, sadly, in Alaska is very common. And I just wanted you to know that it's not just about this bill. You know, if you do have suggestions or anything else, you know, in regards to the bill, we just want you to know that this is not just something we want you to communicate with us today, but over time, if there's things we need to change in our court, because I've heard there's some pretty bad court rules that need to be changed because of what happens to the victims when they go into the courtroom. If there's things you think more than the dating violence that we did in our high schools, you know, education on dating violence, if there's more, we want to know. We want to hear from you, not just, you know, when this bill comes up, but long term, what you were involved in is a fight worth fighting. It's now risen to one of our top priorities, and we just thank you for being on the edge of this and the front line to help us. That we are here to listen, and we really want to say thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. And I'm not seeing anyone else online at this point. Is there anyone in the room who would like to testify in regard to SB 12 and or SB 35? Seeing none, I will close public testimony. And thank you for all those who weighed in. At this time, we are going to move to SB 35 to pick up where we left off. Excuse me. on Friday, and Mr. Skidmore is joining us online. So, Mr. Skidmore, if you would like to continue, just as, and for the public, we began this bill on the 13th with an overview by the Attorney General, Commissioner Price, and Commissioner Dahlstrom, and then Friday we began getting into section by section. So that's where we're going to pick off. Mr. Skidmore, welcome to the Senate Judiciary Committee, and please place your name on the record and begin. I think we left off on, was it section 12? Correct me if I'm wrong.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. My name is John Skidmore. I'm the director for the Criminal Division for the State of Alaska Department of Law.
Mr. Skidmore, you're going to have to speak a little more loudly, at least for me. I have a little bit of a hearing deficit, and you're coming in a little bit soft.
Very well. Am I better now?
Yes.
Great. So I was just looking at the bill. I believe we did leave off at Section 13. Section 13 is similar to what is in SB 12. And so I'm going to skip over Section 13 and move on to Section 14, found on page 6.
Can I say one thing?
Senator Reinbold.
John, basically in Section 12, it just is written, the sectional is written really bizarrely. So if you just read the last line of Section 12, I mean, it can be interpreted multiple different ways. My recommendation would just be that you would revise that so it's clear.
So through the chair, Senator Reinbold, I understand you're talking about Section 12, and I just wanted to be clear. Are you suggesting that there's something wrong with the way the bill is written or just the sectional analysis, ma'am?
Through the chair, the sectional analysis.
Great. We will certainly take a look at that, and we can talk about how to amend that to make it clearer in Section 12. Section 13, as I indicated, was what is now going to be, I believe, part of SB 12. So I move on to Section 14 at the bottom of page 6. And Section 14 creates an enhanced sentencing structure for assault in the second degree. What that means, and the reason it's in this particular bill, is it's talking about strangulation, that particular subsection of assault in the second degree. And in criminal justice reform, when all of the sentencing, presumptive sentencing ranges were adjusted down, this is a Class B felony. It went from 1 to 3 years down to 0 to 2. And what this proposes for that particular subsection is to move it back to 1 to 3 so that anyone that were to engage in an assault in the second degree, which includes the conduct of strangulation, would be facing a presumptive of 1 to 3 years. This actually is complementary to what Senator Michicki has done in SB 12, where you then have strangulation to the point of unconsciousness at an A felony as opposed to a B felony. I will note that this particular section 14, is somewhat overlapping of a section in SB 32, which was seeking to move all sentencing back to where it was prior to SB 91, but if for any reason 32 were not to make it through the legislature, this particular section in this bill ensures that at least those assault offenses that include strangulation would see that increased sentencing range.
Senator Reinbold?
And that's not just for the first offense, but also for the second and the third offenses as well. I'm going to move on to Section 15 then.
Senator Reinbold has a question, Mr. Skidmore.
Okay. I just want to make sure that I heard this right. What were the sentences under SB 91 and then the ones that you were suggesting for the strangulation? Did you say that it's 0 to 2 years and you're only wanting 1 to 3? Is that all the value that victims' trauma is worth?
Through the chair, Senator Reinbold, prior to SB 91, Class B felonies for a first offense was sentenced at 1 to 3 years, a second offense was at 4 to 7, and a third offense was 6 to 10. under SB 91, the first offense was reduced down to 0 to 2. I don't recall off the top of my head the provisions for both the second and third offenses. I can look that up if you'd like me to. What this bill proposed to do was to return those provisions to where they were prior to SB 91. To answer your question of do I think that that amount of time is appropriate, I can tell you that that's the amount of time that was in statute prior. There are aggravators that we would certainly try and look at in any case. And if this committee thought that those levels were not high enough, then we're always willing to talk with the committee and work with the committee on where you think that it ought to be.
And Senator,
the proposal was simply returning it to where it was prior to SB 91.
Senator Reinbold, I will say that I had conversations this morning with the Department of Law with what I believe might be your same concern, that they aren't high enough, and we're looking at that. I was surprised that minimal amount of time. And while we're on that topic, I also want to point out something I've discussed with Senator Marchicki, is that strangulation for the purpose of hurting someone, just in a violent, perhaps a domestic violent situation or other violent situation, the goal is to hurt, intimidate the person. But when strangulation is connected to a sexual offense, it not only is to hurt and intimidate the person, but it is also to take advantage of the person. So to me, it rises to a whole different level of concern. And so we're looking at how we might be able to address that as well. So, Senator Reinbold, you have a follow-up.
Well, and I'm just appalled if they can do this the third time. Actually, they get caught the third time. It's 6 to 10 years. I mean, I guess it makes me realize why there's so much crime up here. If our, even pre-SB 91, I said I thought our laws were way too soft. That's why I thought it was absolutely incredibly lunacy to pass SB 191. I think everybody in the state probably knows that by now. But to think we had such dramatic domestic violence and sexual assault in Alaska and then passed that bill that lowered the sentences, that ended up letting people earn credit, that produce this silly pretrial risk assessment tool that lets so many people out. But this just makes me, like, shocked that the third time they do something like that, even with the correction, it's 6 to 10 years, and then you add on the earned compliance credit and all that stuff, they might be walking really quickly. I just don't think this is enough.
Thank you, Senator Reinbold. Senator Marchicki.
So to clarify for the public, if we make the changes we're talking about, there'll be three levels of strangulation. And the third level would be a much higher. So the one that we're talking about in section 14, if you can please clarify for me, Mr. Skidmore, this is strangulation, period, charges assault, not strangulation related to strangulation that results in someone becoming unconscious, or strangulation resulting in a sexual assault. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Senator Marchicki, you are correct. Section 14 is just talking about the strangulation as we have it under the law now. SB 12, should that pass, creates a second tier of strangulation offenses where somebody is strangled to the point of unconsciousness. And the concept that Chair Hughes has discussed is trying to have some sort of enhanced sentence associated with strangulation, wherein it's associated with some sort of sex offense. That's not in any bill currently, but she is correct. That's a conversation that she started with our department this morning, and we'll continue to work with any member of the committee that's interested in amendments and discussing how they might operate and what they might look.
Madam Chair, if I may.
A follow-up, Senator Marchicki.
I'm just clarifying for the public that we are repealing that section of 91, in case they cannot tell by our conversation. We are repealing that section of Senate Bill 91 and adding two additional layers of much stricter law on top of 91. So I think it's easy in our conversations for folks to become confused on the, and I don't mean anyone here, I just mean people out there that just watch us periodically. This will be repealing 91 in this particular section, and if we make the amendment you're talking about to Senate Bill 12, we would have three layers, with two layers being significantly stricter related to unconsciousness and sexual assault.
Yes, and also I'll just bring up here, too, to be transparent, since this is a process, we are, looks like we are going to put all the things regarding strangulation into SB 12, so we're going over it right now in SB 35, but we're going to combine everything in SB 12 for clarity, so it's all in one bill, and everything can be put together, so the public and the next committee of referral will be able to grasp what we're doing with that as far as policy. Senator Reinbold.
And thank you. And I want to make sure that people understand that I still don't think, even with these changes, because it says if the offense is a first felony, a child under 16 age, 2 to 4 years, with 16 or older, 1 to 3 years. If the offense is a second felony, 2 to 5 years, a third felony, 4 to 10 years, and we could go on. Then after that, there's the different issues, 1 to 3 years, if the offense was a second felony, 4 to 7, and if the offense was a third, 6 to 10. But my point was, even a third time, 6 years, and then there's all those other ways that they can earn credits and ways to get out, and electronic monitoring and all that other kind of stuff. It just still doesn't seem like we're taking violent crimes seriously enough in this state. I stand firm in my beliefs.
Thank you for that input. Mr. Skidmore, will you please continue?
The next section that we come to is Section 15, found on page 7, and what Section 15 does is it adds an offense for enticement of a minor, for sexual abuse of a minor in the third degree. Right now, it'll increase the sentencing, essentially, if there's a six-year age gap. And let me explain that a little more fully. Sexual abuse of a minor in the third degree is when the victim is 13, 14, or 15 years of age. And there is a four-year age difference between the offender and the victim, and this is for sexual contact. What the bill talks about doing here, what this section does, is it says if they are close in age, that is 4 years or 5 years apart, it's still a felony, but it is not a sexual felony. What I mean by that is under Alaska statute, 1255, subsection I, there are provisions that have greater presumptive sentencing range for sex offenses than for a regular felony. Sexual abuse of a minor in the third degree is currently classified as just a regular C felony and does not carry with it those enhanced sentencing ranges for a sexual felony. Specifically, if it did, it would be 2 to 12 years for a first offense as opposed to 0 to 2. And what this section does is it increases it to that 2 to 12 year when the age difference is 6 years or more. The idea being that while it's still against the law, between if there's a 4 or 5 year age difference, once you get to that 6 year age difference, it really is seen as more of that predatory behavior. I think we heard one of our public members testify earlier this morning about a situation in which she had been a victim and there was that six-year age difference. That's really the level that this bill proposes to turn this into that greater offense that carries a much more significant penalty. So that's what Section 15 does.
All right. I don't see any questions, so continue, please.
Section 16, and Section 15 goes for several pages, so Section 16 is actually found on page 10 of the bill. And what Section 16 does is it's clarifying the prior felonies for purposes of sex offenses. You all recall that when we began the sectional analysis on this bill, there was some intent language, and that intent language was overturning a case, and it was overturning a case that said for a sex offense to get to the higher presumptive ranges, that is, there had been a prior offense committed to get to the higher presumptive range. If that prior had been a sex offense, then the current offense would certainly be deemed a higher level on the presumptive range and a greater sentence. But if the prior offense was a non-sex offense, it was applying a 10-year limitation in terms of looking back for those offenses. To put it in another way, when you have presumptive sentencing, the prior felony only counts if it is within a certain time frame in order to increase the presumptive sentencing for the current offense. And for sex offenses, there is no time frame. For all other felonies, there was. And this particular case said that the court was interpreting the statute as though there was a time frame for a prior non-sex felony when determining presumptive sentencing. This section removes that to say if someone has been convicted of a felony before, it does not matter how long ago that conviction was. It will result in an increase in the presumptive range for the current sex offense that the courts would be analyzing. That's what Section 16 does.
Mr. Skidmore, so no time limit and any felony would count, not just sexual felonies, correct?
To the chair, that's correct. I want to be clear that the law currently says that a non-sex prior can increase sentencing, but only if it's within 10 years. And so what this is doing is it's eliminating that 10 years to make it clear that that 10 years shouldn't be considered when you are currently sentencing a sex offense. So regardless if the prior was a sex offense or a non-sex offense, you want to get rid of that time frame for presumptive sentencing. And I apologize, this is somewhat confusing when you try and describe it that way, but I hope that makes it clear.
Yeah, thank you.
Continue. I'm then going to move on to Section 17, and we're now on page 12 of the bill. What Section 17 does is it's a conforming amendment dealing with the crime of enticing a minor, and it's part of the definition of a most serious felony. And so it's just changing some of the language. This is conforming to a change that we had made earlier in the bill. Section 18, which is also on page 12, adds sexual abuse of a minor in the third degree when there is that six-year age difference. Again, this is the thing we talked about before. It's adding it in here. So this is sort of a conforming amendment, but this particular part of it is adding it to the definition of a sexual felony. And that's significant for these reasons. This is not the section that increases the sentencing range, but it does have other impacts by defining it as a sexual felony. For instance, this impacts the treatment that can be imposed. It also affects whether or not there would be early termination. This particular definition has consequences aside from the amount of jail time that's imposed, but in terms of other factors that are considered in sentencing. And that's why we want to change this definition as well to ensure that sexual abuse of a minor, when there is that six-year age difference, has all of these other aspects that are important to the sentencing as well. Section 19 then takes us to page 13, and Section 19 adds a person who is required to register as a sex offender or child kidnapper from another jurisdiction to the element of sex offender or child kidnapper. Again, Section 19 takes us back to the intent language that we talked about at the previous hearing where we were overturning a appellate case that said individuals from another state, when they are required to register in that other state for a conviction, would not necessarily have to register here. We are changing the language of our law so that they are required to register here. That intent language marries up here with Section 19, and we had a considerable discussion on that at the last hearing.
Senator Michiki has a question or comment.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Skidmore. Just on the Section 12 and Section 18, Section 15 and Section 18, So can you help me with it? The reason why I was under the impression is that it was a sexual assault for someone under the age of consent, because it requires consent to not be a sexual assault, and someone under a certain age was not capable of consent. What is the age of consent in Alaska?
Through the chair, Senator Michicki, we don't actually call it sexual assault. We refer to it as sexual abuse of a minor. You are correct that it's about sexual abuse of a minor does not carry an element of consent or lack of consent. It just says when the sexual act occurs between these individuals. And there are a series of factors that look at that to say there is no possibility of consent that occurs here. This is just straight out criminal. And the reason I say that there's a series of factors is the age of consent is generally deemed to be 16 if you think of it in sort of layman's terms, but our statutes talk about it when the victim is 13, 14, or 15, and then there are other statutes that talk about it when the victim is under the age of 13. But it is 13, 14, or 15 that consent is not an element at all. It only becomes an element for sexual assault when the person is over the age of 16. Answer your question.
Senator Michicki.
Sort of. It actually just gets to my question. So my question is, if they were under the age of the ability to consent, why is a six-year difference, why is it not as serious whether or not there's a six-year difference in age?
Through the chair, Senator Michicki, the rationale behind this, and this is one of those areas where I want to be clear, I am not providing an answer that says this is my opinion on the way things should be. I'm rather trying to explain what the law says and why that difference is there. The concept is that you can have young people that are close in age that decide that they want to be involved in a romantic relationship, and that relationship ends up having some sort of physical sexual conduct between the two of them. Our law, our society at this point has said when they are close in age, we are not wanting to turn the either individual into a sex offender who has to register, who has to go to jail, that when they are close enough in age, those are things that while parents may not approve of it, it's not the sort of thing that we want to say is a crime that needs to be punished by jail time and the other consequences of having been convicted of it. Our state has chosen 16 years of age as the age of consent, and our laws require at least a four-year age difference between those individuals before it becomes criminal. And again, the difference between the sexual abuse of a minor for that four-year age difference and the six-year age difference that this bill discusses is not that one is legal and the other is not. They are both illegal. It is just a greater punishment once you get to a six-year age difference.
That's fine. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Thank you very much. And we are coming up on 3 o'clock, and I know that my members have another committee meeting, and I want to continue getting through this. And I do have a few things that may take it past 3. So if the members need to leave for their next committee, that's fine, but I'm going to continue on the questions so that we'll kind of get through what we need to know about the bill in order to proceed with our work on the bill. So you were on Section 19, and I know we had quite the discussion about the sex offender registry, but I do have a question in that regard. On that topic again, in regard to juvenile convictions, because there was a recent KTVA news story earlier this month, and it opened with the following, which I'm going to read. A sex offender from Iowa said he chose to move to Alaska, believing he wouldn't have to register as a sex offender. He was right, and it's a reality that he would continue even if the governor's crime bills are passed. This particular sex offender was convicted recently for sexual assault of a child that included penetration, which occurred just days after the offender arrived to Alaska. So the provisions of SB 35 don't close this gap because there's no requirement for registry for persons who are convicted of sex crimes as a juvenile, which is the case for this particular child rapist. If we were to amend SB 35 to include this requirement for those adjudicated as juveniles for sex crimes, from a Department of Law's perspective, what should we consider as we develop that requirement? Mr. Skidmore.
Chair Hughes, I can tell you in the state of Alaska that we do not require any juvenile who is adjudicated for a sex crime to register. There is some debate within our state about whether or not requiring juveniles to register would violate the state constitution. That has not been decided and has not been determined by a court of law, but I can tell you that that is an open and ongoing debate within the legal community. To answer your question about causing individuals to register from out of state when they are required to register as a sex offender on a registry from another state for a juvenile adjudication, this bill, SB 35, does not require them to register in Alaska, again, for that same constitutional discussion. That's certainly something we're happy to talk with the committee about, and if the committee wanted to try and propose an amendment like that, we would have to look at the language carefully, and we could provide a more detailed policy analysis, legal analysis about the concerns with the law and whether it would or wouldn't be constitutional. I can tell you there are other states that require juveniles to register when they are adjudicated. Alaska is just not one of those. And again, the reason up until now has been concerns about whether that would violate Alaska's constitution, which obviously no other state has to worry about. But that's certainly something we could discuss further with the committee. I don't have an analysis that I can give you today, but it's the sort of thing that if that's something you all were interested in, then I would want to ensure that we were able to provide a memo that outlines it more thoroughly so that you all could consider it.
If you could do that and be thinking about it and how we might be able to do it, Senator Reinbold, I believe.
Well, I guess this has just been a point of contention since I got down to Juneau, is a lawyer trying to tell us what's constitutional and what's not when we're told that is the role of the courts, not a random lawyer. But that really bothers me when people start using that as a defense of why not to do things, because I think you can take any part of the Constitution, and if you are the head of the criminal justice, which that is your technically your title, then with the administration first is supposed to be public safety. It's supposed to be based on public safety. And these mothers and daughters out there want to know if there is a, you know, someone who has been convicted. And by gosh, you know, if we're going to take this serious, we better start getting these people to register so that people are aware early and can do what they can to protect their daughters in this state. We've got to do things differently. So I'm a big fan of getting them on a registry.
Right. And just to clarify, we're not asking juveniles to register, but these would be, they would at the point when they turn adults. So Senator Michiki, did you have a comment? I wasn't quite sure. So thank you. We'll look forward to a further discussion on that, Mr. Skidmore, and also since we're on the sex offender registry, we did have quite a bit of discussion last week regarding enforcements, were we to implement this new sex offender registry laws that we've been talking about. But I want to ask, could we avoid the ex post facto issue that we discussed for enforcement as long as the offenders already that are current residents in the state are provided a period of time to register once the law is passed? Meaning that if the law were to take effect immediately, could it include a provision that anyone already residing, already working in the state, that they'd have a, let's say, a 90-day period to comply with the new law by registering with the Department of Public Safety? I'm just wondering if that would work. In other words, they wouldn't be charged for not registering when they first arrived in the state, since there was no such law that required them to do so, but they'd be charged for not registering between certain dates, being the effective date of the bill, and let's say 90 days out. Would that work?
Through the chair, I understand your question. My answer is I don't know off the top of my head. I would want to go back and do some research, have some others look at that as well. I could certainly be prepared to give you an answer to that later in the week, but I would need several days to make sure that I'm not just sort of giving you something off the top of my head. Really, any time that I'm testifying for you all about any legal analysis, I do try to make sure that we've had the opportunity to do a thorough analysis on those things, because I don't ever want it to just be my opinion. I really do want it to be a thorough review of the law that we're providing you all advice about.
Well, we certainly appreciate that, because we want to get it right, too, so we want you to get it right. So, Senator Michicki.
Well, I think there are a lot of different areas to look at on that subject. I mean, we have public documentation in other states of individuals that are required to be on the sex registry, sex offender registry, but not in Alaska. And I think that's maybe an outside-of-the-box thing, Madam Chair, and I think we should look at it in this bill as well on sort of pushing the envelope. I think the term was ex post facto on sort of a double jeopardy kind of thing almost, but the reality of it is we're not reconvicting and we're not repenalizing. It's simply communicating a post conviction condition from elsewhere, and I think that's where the break would be. And you know what might be really good about 35 and 12 is if there's something we want to push on 35, we have the option to do that while we get most of the or a lot of the sexual assault issues done in 12 and keep it clean and perhaps push the envelope on some of these other issues in 35.
Mm-hmm. All right. If you want to continue, Mr. Skidmore, going through till we get to the end of the bill, then I'm going to have one more question on a topic, but I'll go ahead and let you finish up getting through the sections.
So, Madam Chair, there's really only three more sections for me to talk about, and then there's the applicability and the effective date. But Section 20 is the next one we come to. That's still on page 13. And what 20 does is it adds the crime of indecent viewing or production of a person under the age of 16, or the indecent production of a photograph of an adult to the list of registrable sex offenses. You'll recall we had some discussion last time about the difference of how this particular crime is broken down into sort of four categories. There is the actual viewing, there is the production of the photograph, and then it is the victim a child or is the victim an adult? And what this section does is it says if the victim is a child, either for that viewing or the production, or for the production of a photograph where the victim is an adult, in those three circumstances, that then becomes a registrable sex offense. It is not currently under our law, but Section 20 would change that so that it would become registrable. Section 21 is then found on page 14 of the bill. And this clarifies that a person who is ineligible for a good time deduction from their sentence would also be ineligible for discretionary parole. And just to make sure that everyone's clear on that, for parole there is discretionary parole and there is also mandatory parole, which is done when you behave while in custody. You are then released after you've done essentially two-thirds of your time. And what this says is that if you were ineligible for good time, that is for that mandatory, then you would also be ineligible for discretionary, so that it restricts parole eligibility, and it just ensures that those two marry up with one another. It's in this particular bill because that applies to a number of sex offenses, and so that's why it's here. Finally, then, Section 22. Section 22 is the repealer. There are only two sections that are repealed in here, and those are just consistent with other policies that we've already talked about throughout the bill. So that's the end of the sectional analysis. Obviously, there's the applicability date and the effective date, which would be July 1 of 2019. But those are the last two provisions, and that is the end of the sectional analysis. So if you have additional questions, I'm happy to answer them.
Thank you, Mr. Skidmore. And I'm going to bring up a topic I don't believe we've discussed yet, but I'm thinking of perhaps it might have been better during the SB 12, but we've touched on things related to the Justin Schneider case in SB 35 as well. But the fact in that case that there was an element of kidnapping, but that couldn't be proven, or there was a question whether there was an element of kidnapping. And so I believe as a judiciary community, it's important for us to explore whether or not prosecution has the tools it needs to prove kidnapping when it does occur. And so this comes to mind, of course, in the Schneider case, because the victim did get into the vehicle willingly, and was not restrained in the sense of being tied with a rope or being put in the trunk of a car. But when a vehicle is moving, it is somewhat of a sense of a restraint. You just can't walk away when the vehicle's moving. I understand the prosecution felt in this case that kidnapping charge couldn't be proved, but can you address for the record how the facts of this case maybe led the prosecution to determining to drop the kidnapping charge, but and let us know how often convictions for kidnapping are happening in Alaska. And since we're talking about this, is this a time for the Department of Law to tell us in respect to the kidnapping statute to avoid having to drop a charge like happened in the Justin Schneider case? Is there something that we need to do to change in statute? I have the sense that vehicles are often used to take young females to certain places for the purpose of sexual assault, and just wondering if we were to add something related to kidnapping or transporting, whether we might deter some of that activity. So could you tell us how that went, and with the Justin Schneider case, is there anything that we need to do as far as fixing the statute so the transport or the concept of restraint, et cetera, because girls are tricked. Maybe they are asking for a ride somewhere, or they think they're going somewhere when their intent is not for that. And so I just want to explore that as we close out this bill.
Through the chair, kidnapping is found in Alaska Statute 1141-300, and it says that if a person restrains another with the intent to inflict physical injury upon or sexually assault the restrained person, or to place that restrained person or a third person in apprehension that any person will be subjected to serious physical injury or sexual assault, that would be kidnapping. And so the restraint is then later defined, and the definition of restraint means to restrict a person's movements unlawfully and without consent so as to interfere substantially with the person's liberty. By confining the person in the place where the restriction commences, and a restraint is without consent if it is accomplished by force, threat, or deception. So deception can also qualify here, but the difficulty in the Schneider case was twofold. First, when the victim in that case had requested the ride and was offered that ride and then is indeed being taken the direction that she had asked to go in, you have to figure out at what time does that deception kick into it, and how far is the distance that is traveled from that point in time until the offense occurs. And the reason I say that is because while I've read you the statutes, and I believe that's what the prosecutor who looked at the case initially looked at, and that's why Mr. Schneider was indicted for kidnapping originally. But there's other case law as well, and our obligation is to not only look at statutes, but to also look at case law. And the case law says that when a person restrains another with the intent to facilitate the commission of that offense, that restraint will not constitute a separate offense of kidnapping if it is merely incidental to the commission of the offense. And that case law, it actually comes from a Court of Appeals case called Alam, A-L-A-M. And there was actually two different Alam opinions. one that occurred in 1990 and the second one occurred in 1990 and the first one occurred in 1989. And in those two opinions, the same case just looked at twice by the Court of Appeals, they were really talking about this concept of incidental restraint and how far does someone need to move, what is the change in the circumstances of one place of where they are to the other, where does that deception kick in? It was that sort of analysis that when we looked at it more carefully, we said we did not believe we would be able to meet our obligations of proof beyond a reasonable doubt, which obviously isn't something that anyone can change, but proving beyond a reasonable doubt that that deception occurred and the distance being traveled was far enough. Because in the Schneider case, she willingly was in the vehicle. They come to a location. He stops and says, hey, I need to get out. I want to go and get something that I left in this parking lot. Is that okay? She's saying yes. They get to the parking lot. He's asking her to step outside. And only at that moment when he tackles her is it become obvious that she's not willing to do any of this. And it's at that point that we now realize there's been some deception. But at what point that deception started, we didn't have sufficient evidence to prove that, which is why we ultimately concluded that that was not a charge that we would be able to sustain at trial. To your question of, is there something that could be changed in the statutes? Is there something that ought to be changed in the law here? I don't know the answer to that. I would want to go back and look at the Elam set of opinions more carefully and look at the basis that they came to that conclusion that the restraint had to be more than incidental. I would need to look at if that was something that the legislature were to change, what precisely would they need to change, and what's the legal analysis that led them to say that it was only incidental to begin with. In other words, is it statutory? Is it constitutional? Is there some other case law that they were looking at? Getting further into those concepts is what would be required for the Department of Law to provide any advice or guidance about if something wanted to be changed, what would it be and what would it take to change it, right? The law can always be changed, even if it's constitutional. You can change that, but it means you're now having to do a constitutional amendment if that's the level at which it's at. I'm not saying that's what it is here. I'm just trying to describe overall why I don't know. I can't tell you at this time precisely what it might take. But that's certainly something that we can look at, and as we're discussing other provisions with you all, we're happy to discuss those concepts with you as well.
Thank you, Mr. Skidmore. And as you're thinking about whether a tool might be helpful to prosecution, please think outside of the Justin Schneider case, because it is a fact that young women are often taken in vehicles for the purpose of tricked into riding in a vehicle for the purpose of a sexual assault. And so please think beyond that particular, that case. And I want to thank Matt. Thank you, Mr. Skidmore, for getting us through the bill. And actually, this was a different way to go through a bill, but I think it's really helpful. I think we feel like we know, understand every section, have been able to ask questions. I want to thank Matt Davison for being in the room. We don't have time to ask some of the questions, so we might just meet with you individually. There were questions about minors and having to do with the production and viewing of photos and such. So I just want to thank Mr. Davison for being here. Senator Michicki.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll make this quick, but I think it's important that the public know Senator Reinbold and I may completely agree on the fact that some crime needs to be charged more seriously in Alaska. What I think is most important because of the Senate Bill 91 issue is that the public understand where it's been fully repealed, because people have a tendency to sort of blame kind of everything on 91. I want it clarified specifically when we've repealed it. It doesn't mean that we will not be making the law stronger. But what's so important in 12 and 35 is, other than some of the sentencing limits, most of these problems in our sexual assault laws are decades old.
Mm-hmm.
These are not new. These are not new problems. So this is a little different than the other Series 30 crime bills that is repealing 91. This is making our laws tougher, unrelated to 91, because it needed to happen a long time ago. Folks say don't always rely on the Justin Schneider case, but sometimes it takes a catalyst for that change to occur, and I think that's one that every Alaskan is quite familiar with the outcome as not being satisfactory. So I just wanted to clear that up. If it looks like there's disagreement, it's really me just trying to clarify the 91 versus other issues to the public, because 91's been such a lightning rod.
Thank you, and thank you for your steady reminder to do that along the way. You've been really good, and I know the public appreciates that. So that this concludes our business today, and on Wednesday we'll have two presentations on crime statistics in Alaska, including as it relates to sexual crimes in our state, and that those will be from the Alaska Judicial Council and Alaska Department on Public Safety. And I also want to let committee members, or my committee member, know that regarding possible committee substitutes for SB 12 and SB 35, my intent is to have a new working document of SB 12 to present to the committee by Friday. We'll be working with Senator Michicki on that. So we'll be in touch. And seeing no other business before the committee, we will adjourn and let the record reflect the time is 3:14 p.m.